Dresden and Catty Bree eyed the drinks suspiciously, knowing they had to keep their heads perfectly clear. But when Berthgar offered a toast to them and held his own mug high, custom demanded they likewise salute. And in Hengorot, one simply did not sip mead. Both friends downed their mugs to rousing cheers, and both looked to each other despairingly as another full mug quickly replaced the emptied one. Unexpectedly, Drizzt rose and deftly hopped up on the long table. "My greetings to the men and women of Settlestone, to the people of Berthgar the Bold," he began, and a chorus of deafening cheers went up, roars for Berthgar, the focus of the town's pride. The huge, shaggy-haired man got slapped on the back 100 times in the next minute, but not once did he blink, and not once did he take his suspicious gaze from the dark elf. Catty Bree understood what was going on here. The barbarians had come to grudgingly accept Drizzt, but still he was a scrawny elf and a dark elf on top of it all. The paradox was more than a little uncomfortable for them. They saw Drizzt as weak, probably no stronger than some of their hearty womenfolk, and yet they realized that not one of them could defeat the drow in combat. Berthgar was the most uncomfortable of all, for he knew why Drizzt and Catty Bree had come, and he suspected this issue about the hammer would be settled between him and Drizzt.
"Truly we are grateful, nay thrilled at your hospitality. None in all the realms can set a table more inviting."
Again the cheers. Drizzt was playing them well, and it didn't hurt that more than half of them were falling down drunk.
"But we cannot remain for long," Drizzt said, his voice suddenly solemn.
The effect on those seated near the drow was stunning, as they seemed to sober immediately, seemed to suddenly grasp the weight of the drow's visit. Catty Bree saw the sparkle of the ruby pendant hanging around Drizzt's neck, and she understood that though Drizzt wasn't actively using the enchanting gem, its mere presence was as intoxicating as any amount of thick mead.
"The heavy sword of war hangs over us all," Drizzt went on gravely. "This is the time of alliance."
Berthgar abruptly ended the drow's speech by slamming his mug on the table so brutally that it shattered, splattering those nearby with golden brown mead and glass fragments. Still holding the mug's handle, the barbarian leader unsteadily clambered atop the table to tower over the dark elf. In the blink of an eye, Hengorot hushed.
"You come here claiming alliance," the barbarian leader began slowly. "You come asking for alliance."
He paused and looked around at his anxious people for dramatic effect.
"And yet you hold prisoner the weapon that has become a symbol of my people, a weapon brought to glory by Wulfgar, son of Beornagar."
Thunderous cheers erupted, and Catty Bree looked up to Drizzt and shrugged helplessly. She always hated it when the barbarians referred to Wulfgar by his legacy as the son of Beornagar. For them to do so was an item of pride, and pride alone never sat well with a pragmatic woman. Besides, Wulfgar needed no claim of lineage to heighten his short life's achievements. His children, had he sired any, would have been the ones to rightfully speak of their father.
"We are friends of the dwarf king you serve, dark elf," Berthgar went on, his booming voice resonating off the stone sections of Hengorot's walls. "And we ask the same of Brunner Battlehammer, son of Bangor, son of Garum. You shall have your alliance, but not until Aegis Fang is delivered to me." "I am Berthgar," the barbarian leader bellowed. "Berthgar the Bold," several of the man's advisers quickly piped in, and another chorus went up, a toast of mugs lifted high to the mighty chieftain of Settlestone.
"Brunner would sooner deliver his own axe," Drizzt replied, thoroughly fed up with Berthgar's glories. The drow understood then that he and Catty Bree had been expected in Settlestone, for Berthgar's little speech and the reaction to it had been carefully planned, even rehearsed. "And I do not think you would enjoy the way he would deliver that axe," the drow finished quietly, when the roaring had died away, Again came the hush of expectation, for the drow's words could be taken as a challenge, and Birkthgar, blue eyes squinting dangerously, seemed more than ready to pick up the gauntlet.
"But Brunner is not here,"
the barbarian leader said evenly.
"Will Drizzt D'Urden champion his cause?"
Drizzt straightened, trying to decide the best course. Catti Bree's mind, too, was working fast. She held little doubt that Drizzt would accept the challenge and put Birkthgar down at once, and the men of Settlestone surely would not tolerate that kind of embarrassment.
"Wulfgar was to be my husband,"
she yelled, rising from her chair just as Drizzt was about to respond.
"And I am the daughter of Brunner, by rights the princess of Mithril Hall. If anyone here is to champion my father's cause—"
"You will name him," Birkthgar reasoned.
"I will be her,"
Catti Bree replied grimly.
Roars went up again all around the mead hall, and more than a few women at the back of the room tittered and nodded hopefully.
Drizzt didn't seem so pleased, and the look he put over Catti Bree was purely plaintive, begging her to calm this situation before things got fully out of hand. He didn't want to fight at all, neither did Catti Bree, but the room was in a frenzy then, with more than half the voices crying for Birkthgar to
fight the woman as though Catti Bree's challenge had already been launched.
The look that Birkthgar put over Catti Bree was one of pure outrage. She understood and sympathized with his predicament. She had meant to go on and explain that she would be Brunner's only champion, if there was to be a champion, but that she had not come here to fight. Events had swept her past that point, however.
"Never!"
Birkthgar roared above the din, and the room calmed somewhat, eager cries dying away to whispers.
"Never have I battled a woman!"
That's an attitude Birkthgar had better overcome soon, Drizzt thought. For if the Dark Elves were indeed marching to Mithril Hall, there would be little room for such inhibitions. Females were typically the strongest of drow warriors, both magically and with weapons.
"Fight her!"
cried one man, obviously very drunk, and he was laughing as he called, and so too were his fellows around him. Birkthgar looked from the man to Catti Bree, his huge chest heaving as he tried to take in deep breaths to calm his rage. He could not win, Catti Bree realized. If they fought, he could not win, even if he battered her. To the hearty men of Settlestone, even lifting a weapon against her would be considered cowardly. Catti Bree climbed onto the table and gave a slight nod as she passed in front of Drizzt. Hands on hips, and her hip out to the side to accentuate her feminine figure, she gave a wistful smile to the barbarian leader.
"Not with weapons, perhaps," she said. "But there are other ways a man and woman might compete."
All the room exploded at that comment. Mugs were lifted so forcefully in toast that little mead remained in them as they came back down to the eager mouths of the men. Several in the back end of Hengarot took up a lewd song, clapping each other on the back at every crescendo. Drizzt's lavender eyes grew so wide that they seemed as if they would simply roll out of their sockets. When Catti Bree took the moment to regard him, she feared he would draw his weapons and kill everyone in the room. For an instant she was flattered, but that quickly passed, replaced by disappointment that the drow would think so little of her. She gave him a look that said just that as she turned and jumped down from the table. A man nearby reached out to catch her, but she slapped his hands away and strode defiantly for the door.
"There's fire in that one,"
she heard behind her.
"Alas for poor Birkthgar,"
came another rowdy cry. On the table, the stunned barbarian leader turned this way and that, purposely avoiding the dark elf's gaze. Birkthgar was at a loss. Brunner's daughter, though a famed adventurer, was not known for such antics. But Birkthgar was also more than a little intrigued. Every man in Settlestone considered Catti Bree, the princess of Mithril Hall, the fairest prize in all the region.
"Aegis Fang will be mine,"
Birkthgar finally cried, and the roar behind him and all around him was deafening.
The barbarian leader was relieved to see that Drizzt was no longer facing him, was no longer anywhere in sight when he turned back. One great leap had taken the dark elf from the table, and he strode eagerly for the door. Outside Hengarot, in a quiet spot near an empty house, Drizzt took Catibree by the arm and turned her to face him. She expected him to shout at her, even expected him to slap her. He laughed at her instead.
"Clever," Drizzt congratulated. "But can you take him?"
"How do ye know that I did not mean what I said?" Catibree snapped in reply.
"Because you have more respect for yourself than that," Drizzt answered without hesitation. It was the perfect answer, the one Catibree needed to hear from her friend, and she did not press the point further.
"But can you take him?" the drow asked again, seriously.
Catibree was good and getting better with every lesson, but Berkthgar was huge and tremendously strong. "He's drunk," Catibree replied, "and he's slow, like Wulfgar was before ye showed him the better way of fighting."
Her blue eyes, rich as the sky just before the dawn, sparkled.
"Like he showed me?"
Drizzt patted her on the shoulder lightly, understanding then that this fight would be as important to her as it was to Berkthgar.
The barbarian came storming out of the tent then, leaving a horde of sputtering comrades leering out of the open flap. "Taking him won't be half the trouble as figuring out how to let him keep his honor," Catibree whispered.
Drizzt nodded and patted her shoulder again, then walked away, going in a wide circuit around Berkthgar and back toward the tent. Catibree had taken things into hand, he decided, and he owed her the respect to let her see this through. The barbarians fell back as the drow came into the tent and pointedly closed the flap, taking one last look at Catibree as he did, to see her walking side by side with Berkthgar, and he so resembled huge Wulfgar from the back, down the windswept lane. For Drizzt O'Urden, the image was not a pleasant one.
"You're not surprised?" Catibree asked as she removed the practice padding from her backpack and began sliding it over the fine edge of her sword. She felt a twinge of emotion as she did so, a sudden feeling of disappointment, even anger, which she did not understand.
"I did not believe for a moment that you had brought me out here for the reason you hinted at," Berkthgar replied casually. "Though if you had—"
"Shut your mouth,"
Catibree sharply interrupted. Berkthgar's jaw went firm. He was not accustomed to being talked to in that manner, particularly not from a woman.
"We have Settlestone. Do not cover our blades when we fight," he said boastfully.
Catibree returned the barbarian leader's determined look, and as she did, she slid the sword back out from its protective sheath. A sudden rush of elation washed over her. As with the earlier feeling, she did not understand it, and so she thought that perhaps her anger toward Berkthgar was more profound than she had dared to admit to herself. Berkthgar walked away then, to his house, and soon returned wearing a smug smile and a sheath strapped across his back. Above his right shoulder, Catibree could see the hilt and crosspiece of his sword, a crosspiece nearly as long as her entire blade, and the bottom portion of the sheath poked out from below Berkthgar's left hip, extending almost to the ground. Catibree watched, awestruck, wondering what she had gotten herself into, as Berkthgar solemnly drew the sword to the extent of his arm. The sheath had been cut along its upper side after a foot of leather, so that the barbarian could then extract the gigantic blade. And gigantic indeed was Berkthgar's Flamberga. Its wavy blade extended over 4 feet, and after that came an 8-inch ricasso between the formal crosspiece and a second, smaller one of edged steel. With one arm, muscles standing taut in iron-like cords, Berkthgar began spinning the blade, creating a whooshing sound in the air above his head. Then he brought its tip to the ground before him and rested his arm on the crosspiece, which was about shoulder height to his 6.5-foot frame.
"Ye meaning to fight with that, or kill fatted cows?"
Catibree asked, trying hard to steal some of the man's mounting pride.
I would still allow you to choose the other contest, Berthgar replied calmly.
Catti Bree's sword snapped out in front of her, at the ready, and she went down in a low, defensive crouch. The barbarian hooted and went into a similar pose, but then straightened, looking perplexed.
I cannot, Berthgar began. If I were to strike you even a glancing blow, King Battlehammer's heart would break as surely as would your skull.
Catti Bree came forward suddenly, jabbing at Berthgar's shoulder and tearing a line in his furred jerkin. He looked down at the cut, then his eyes came slowly back to regard Catti Bree. But other than that, he made no move.
You're just afraid because you're knowing that ye can't move that cow-killer fast enough, the young woman taunted.
Berthgar blinked very slowly, exaggerated the movement as if to show how boring he thought this whole affair was.
I will show you the mantle where Bunk and Fuera is kept, he said. And I will show you the bedding before the mantle.
The thing's better for a mantle than a swordsman's hands,
Catti Bree growled, tired of this one's juvenile sexual references. She sprang ahead again and slapped the flat of her blade hard against Berthgar's cheek, then jumped back, still snarling.
If you're afraid, then admit it.
Berthgar's hand went immediately to his wound, and when it came away, the barbarian saw that his fingers were red with blood. Catti Bree winced at that, for she hadn't meant to hit him quite so hard. Subtle were the intrusions of Cassidea.
I am out of patience with you, foolish woman, snarled the barbarian, and up came the tip of tremendous Bankenfuera, the northern fury.
Berthgar growled and leaped ahead, both hands on the hilt this time, as he swung the huge blade across in front of him. He attacked with the flat of his blade, as had Catti Bree, but the young woman realized that would hardly matter. Getting hit by the flat of that tremendous Flamberga would still reduce her bones to mush. Catti Bree wasn't anywhere near Berthgar at that point, the woman in fast retreat, and wondering again if she was in over her head as soon as the sword went up. The Flamberga curled in an arc back over, left to right, then came across a second time, this cut angling down. Faster than Catti Bree expected, Berthgar reversed the flow, the blade swishing horizontally again, this time left to right, then settled back at the ready beside the barbarian's muscular shoulder. An impressive display indeed, but Catti Bree had watched the routine carefully, no longer through awestruck eyes, and she noticed more than a few holes in the barbarian's defenses. Of course, she had to be perfect in her timing. One slip, and Bankenfuera would turn her into worm food. On came Berthgar with another horizontal cut, a predictable attack, for there were only so many ways one could maneuver such a weapon. Catti Bree fell back a step, then an extra step just to make sure, and darted in behind the lumbering sweep of the blade, looking to score a hit on the barbarian's arm. Berthgar was quicker than that, though, and he had the blade coming around and over so fast that Catti Bree had to abort the attack and scramble hard just to get out of the way. Still, she had won that pass, she figured, for now she had a better measure of Berthgar's reach. And by her thinking, every passing moment favored her, for she saw the sweat beading on the drunken barbarian's forehead, his great chest heaving just a bit more than before.
If ye do other things as poorly as ye fight, then sure and I'm glad I chose this contest,
Catti Bree said, a taunt that sent proud Berthgar into another wild swinging tirade. Catti Bree dodged and scrambled as Bankenfuera came around in several titanic and ultimately futile swipes. Across it came again, the barbarian's fury far from played out, and Catti Bree leaped back. Around and over went the blade, Berthgar charging ahead, and Catti Bree went far out to the side, just ahead, as the great sword came whipping down and across.
I shall catch up to you soon enough, Berthgar promised, turning square to the young woman and whipping his mighty blade left to right once more, bringing it to the ready beside his right shoulder.
Catti Bree started in behind the cut, taking a long stride with her right foot, extending her sword arm toward Berthgar's exposed hip. She dug her left foot in solidly, though, and had no intention of continuing the move. As soon as Bankenfuera came across to intercept, Catti Bree leaped back,
pivoted on her anchor leg and rushed in behind the blade, going for Berkthgar's right hip instead, and scored a nasty, stinging hit. The barbarian growled and spun so forcefully that he nearly overbalanced. Catti Bree stood a few feet away, crouched low, ready. There was no doubt that swinging the heavy weapon was beginning to take a toll on the man, especially after his generous swallows of mead. "A few more passes," Catti Bree whispered, forcing herself to be patient. And so she played on as the minutes passed, as Berkthgar's breathing came as loudly as the moaning wind. Through each attack, Catti Bree confirmed her final routine, one that took advantage of the fact that Berkthgar's huge blade and thick arms made a perfect optical barricade. Drizzt suffered through the half-hour of rude comments.
"Never has he lasted this long," offered one barbarian. "Berkthgar the Brazen," cried another, the barbarian word for stamina. "Brazen!" all the rowdy men shouted together, lifting their mugs in cheer. Some of the women in the back of Hengarot tittered at the bawdy display, but most wore sour expressions.
"Brazen," the drow whispered.
And Drizzt thought the word perfectly fitting for describing his own patience during those insufferably long minutes. As angry as he was at the rude jokes at Catti Bree's expense, he was more fearful that Berkthgar would harm her, perhaps defeat her in battle and take her in other ways. Drizzt worked hard to keep his imagination at bay. For all his boasting, for all of his people's boasting, Berkthgar was an honorable man, but he was drunk. "I will kill him," Drizzt decided. And if anything the drow feared had come to pass, he indeed would cut mighty Berkthgar down. It never got to that point, though, for Berkthgar and Catti Bree walked back into the tent, looking a bit ruffled, the barbarian's stubbly beard darkened in one area with some dried blood, but otherwise seeming okay. Catti Bree winked subtly as she passed the drow. Hengarot fell into a hush, the drunken men no doubt expecting some lewd tales of their leader's exploits. Berkthgar looked to Catti Bree, and she wouldn't blink.
"I will not carry Aegis Fang," the barbarian leader announced.
Moans and hoots erupted, as did speculation about who won the contest. Berkthgar blushed, and Drizzt feared there would be trouble. Catti Bree went up on the table. "Not a better man in Settlestone," she insisted. Several barbarians rushed forward to the table's edge, willing to take up that challenge. "Not a better man," Catti Bree growled at them, her fury driving them back.
"I'll not carry the warhammer, in honor of Wulfgar," Berkthgar explained. "And for the honor of Catti Bree."
Blank stares came back at him.
"If I am to properly suit the daughter of King Brunner, our friend and ally," the barbarian leader went on, and Drizzt smiled at that reference, "then it is my own weapon, Bonkenfuera, that must become legend."
He held high the huge Flamberga, and the crowd roared with glee. The issue was ended, the alliance sealed, and more mead was passed around before Catti Bree even got down from the table, heading for Drizzt. She stopped as she walked beside the barbarian leader and gave him a sly look. "If he ever openly lie," she whispered, taking care that no one could hear, "or if he ever even hint that ye betted me, then be knowing that I'll come back and cut ye down in front of all your people." Berkthgar's expression grew somber at that, and even more somber as he turned to watch Catti Bree depart, to see her deadly drow friend standing easily, hands on scimitar hilts, his lavender eyes telling the barbarian in no uncertain terms his feelings for Catti Bree. Berkthgar didn't want to tangle with Catti Bree again, but he would rather battle her 100 times than fight the drow ranger.
"You'll come back and cut him down," Drizzt asked as they exited the town, revealing to Catti Bree that his keen ears had caught her parting words with the barbarian.
"Not a promise I'd ever want to try," Catti Bree replied, shaking her head. "Fighting that one when he's not so full of mead, would be about the same as walking into the cave of a restless bear."
Drizzt stopped abruptly, and Catti Bree, after taking a couple more steps, turned around to regard him. He stood pointing at her, smiling widely.
"I have done that," he remarked.
And so Drizzt had yet another tale to recount, as the two, and three, for Drizzt was quick to recall Guinevere, made their way along the trails back into the mountains. Later, as the stars twinkled brightly and the campfire burned low, Drizzt sat watching Catti Bree's prone form, her rhythmic breathing telling the drow that she was fast asleep.
"You know I love her," the drow said to Guinevere.
The panther blinked her shining green eyes, but otherwise did not move.
"Yet how could I?" Drizzt asked.
"And not for the memory of Wulfgar," he quickly added, and he nodded as he heard himself speak the words, knowing that Wulfgar, who loved Drizzt as Drizzt loved him, would not disapprove.
"How could I ever?"
the drow reiterated, his voice barely a whisper. Guinevere issued a long, low growl. But if it had any meaning, other than to convey that the panther was interested in what the drow was saying, it was lost on Drizzt.
"She will not live so long," Drizzt went on quietly. "I will still be a young drow when she is gone."
Drizzt looked from Catti Bree to the panther, and a new insight occurred to him.
"You must understand such things, my eternal friend," the drow said. "Where will I fall in the span of your life? How many others have you kept as you keep me, my Guinevere? And how many more shall there be?"
Drizzt rested his back against the mountain wall and looked to Catti Bree, then up to the stars. Sad were his thoughts, and yet, in many ways, they were comforting, like an eternal play, like emotions shared, like memories of Wulfgar. Drizzt sent those thoughts skyward, into the heavenly canopy, letting them break apart on the ceaseless and mournful wind. His dreams were full of images of friends, of Zacnaphane, his father, of Belwar, the Zwerfneblin gnome, of Captain Dudermont, of the good ship Sea Sprite, of Regis and Brunner, of Wulfgar, and most of all, of Catti Bree. It was as calm and pleasant a sleep as Drizzt O'Urden had ever known. Guinevere watched the drow for some time, then rested her great feline head on wide paws and closed her green eyes. Drizzt's comments had hit the mark, except, of course, his intimation that her memory of him would be inconsequential in the centuries ahead. Guinevere had indeed come to the call of many masters, most goodly, some wicked in the past millennium, and even beyond that. Some the panther remembered, some not. But Drizzt, forever would Guinevere remember the renegade dark elf, whose heart was so strong and so good, and whose loyalty was no less than the panther's own.
Part 2. The Onset of Chaos. Forever after, the bards of the realms called it the time of troubles, the time when the gods were kicked out of the heavens, their avatars walking among the mortals, the time when the tablets of fate were stolen, invoking the wrath of Ao, overlord of the gods, when magic went awry, and when, as a consequence, social and religious hierarchies, so often based on magical strength, fell into chaos. I have heard many tales from fanatical priests of their encounters with their particular avatars, frenzied stories from men and women who claimed to have looked upon their deities. So many others came to convert to a religion during this troubled time, likewise claiming they had seen the light and the truth, however convoluted it might be. I do not disagree with the claims, and would not openly attack the premise of their encounters. I am glad for those who have found enrichment amidst the chaos. I am glad whenever another person finds the contentment of spiritual guidance. But what of faith? What of fidelity and loyalty, complete trust? Faith is not granted by tangible proof. It comes from the heart and the soul. If a person needs proof of a God's existence, then the very notion of spirituality is diminished into sensuality, and we have reduced what is holy into what is logical. I have touched the unicorn, so rare and so precious, the symbol of the goddess Mialiki, who holds my heart and soul. This was before the onset of the time of troubles. Yet were I of a like mind to those who make the claims of viewing avatars, I could say the same. I could say that I have touched Mialiki, that she came to me in a magical glade in the mountains near Dead Orc Pass. The unicorn was not Mialiki. And yet it was. As is the sunrise and the seasons, as are the birds and the squirrels, and the strength of a tree that has lived through the dawn and death of centuries, as are the leaves blowing on autumn winds and the snow piling deep in cold mountain vales, as are the smell of a crisp night, the twinkle of the starry canopy, and the howl of a distant wolf. I'll not argue openly against one who has claimed to have seen an avatar, because that person will not understand that the mere presence of such a being undermines the very purpose of and value of faith. Because if the true gods were so tangible and so accessible, then we would no longer be independent creatures set on a journey to find the truth, but merely a herd of sheep needing the guidance of a shepherd and his dogs, unthinking and without the essence of faith. The guidance is there, I know. Not in such a tangible form, but in what we know to be good and just. It is our own reactions to the acts of others that show us the value of our own actions. And if we have fallen so far as to need an avatar, an undeniable manifestation of a god, to show us our way, then we are pitiful creatures indeed. The time of troubles? Yes. And even more so if we are to believe the suggestion of avatars, because truth is singular and cannot, by definition, support so many varied, even opposing manifestations. The unicorn was not Mialiki, and yet it was, for I have touched Mialiki, not as an avatar or as a unicorn, but as a way of viewing my place in the world. Mialiki is my heart. I follow her precepts because, were I to write precepts based on my own conscience, they would be the same. I follow Mialiki because she represents what I call truth. Such is the case for most of the followers of most of the various gods. And if we looked more closely at the pantheon of the realms, we would realize that the precepts of the goodly gods are not so different. It is the worldly interpretation of those precepts that vary from faith to faith. As for the other gods, the gods of strife and chaos, such as Lolth, the Spider Queen, who possesses the hearts of those priestesses who rule Menzo Berenzon, they are not worth mentioning. There is no truth, only worldly gain, and any religion based on such principles is, in fact, no more than a practice of self-indulgence, and in no way a measure of spirituality. In worldly terms, the priestesses of the Spider Queen are quite formidable. In spiritual terms, they are empty. Thus, their lives are without love and without joy. So tell me not of avatars. Show me not your proof that yours is the true God. I grant you your beliefs without question and without judgment. But if you grant me what is in my heart, then such tangible evidence is irrelevant. Drizzt Do'Urden. Chapter 6 When Magic Went Awry. Bourguignon Bayenry, weapons master of the first house of Menzo Baranzon, put his twin swords through a dizzying routine, blades spinning circuits in the air between him and his opponent, an insubordinate drow common soldier. A crowd of the Bayenry House Guard, highly trained though mostly males, formed a semicircle around the pair, while other dark elves watched from high perches, tightly saddled astride sticky-footed, huge subterranean lizards, the beasts casually standing along the vertical slopes of nearby stalactites or towering stalagmite mounds. Though few thought him as good a swordsman as his brother Dantrak had been, the soldiers cheered every time Bourguignon scored a minor hit or parried a fast-flying counter. Bourguignon noticed a reluctance in their praise, though, and knew the source. He had been the leader of the Bayenry Lizard Riders, the most elite grouping of the male house guards for many years. But with Dantrag slain, he had become the house weapons master as well. Bourguignon felt the intense pressure of his dual stations, felt his mother's scrutinizing gaze on his every movement and every decision. He did not doubt that his own actions had intensified as a result. How many fights had he begun? How many punishments had he exacted on his subordinates since Dantrag's death? The common drow came ahead with a weak thrust that almost slipped past distracted Bourguignon's defenses. A sword came up and around at the last moment to drive the enemy's blade aside. Bourguignon heard the sudden hush behind him at the near miss, understood that several of the soldiers back there, perhaps all of them, hoped his enemy's next thrust would be quicker, too quick. The weaponsmaster growled low and came ahead in a flurry, spurred on by the hatred of those around him, of those under his command. Let them hate him, he decided. But while they did, they must also respect him. No, not respect, Bourguignon decided. They must fear him. He came forward one step, then a second, his sword snapping alternately left and right, and each being cleanly picked off. The give and take had become common, with Bourguignon coming ahead two steps, then retreating. This time, though, the Bayenry did not retreat. He shuffled forward two more steps, his sword snapping as his opponent's blades rushed for the parry. Bourguignon had the lesser drow up on his heels, so the young Bayenry rushed ahead again. His opponent was quick enough with his swords to turn the expected thrusts, but he could not retreat properly, and Bourguignon was up against him in a clinch, their blades joined to either side, down low by the hilt. There was no real danger here. It was more like a break in the battle. But Bourguignon realized something his opponent apparently did not. With a growl, the young Bayenry heaved his off-balance opponent away. The drow skidded back a couple of steps, brought his swords up immediately to fend off any pursuit. None came. It seemed a simple break of the clinch. Then the back-pedaling drow bumped into the house Bayenry fence. In the city of Menzo Baranzon, there was perhaps nothing as spectacular as the 20-foot-high, web-designed fence ringing house Bayenry, anchored on the various stalagmite mounds that ringed the compound. Its silvery metallic cords, thick as a dark elf's leg, were wound into beautiful symmetrical designs as intricate as the work of any spider. No weapon could cut through it. No magic, save a single item that Matron Bayenry possessed, could get one over it, and the simplest touch or brush against one of those enchanted strands would hold fast a titan. Bourguignon's opponent hit the fence hard with the flat of his back. His eyes went wide as he suddenly realized the young Bayenry's tactics, and he saw the faces of those gathered brighten in approval of the vicious trick, as he saw devious and wicked Bourguignon calmly approach. The drow fell away from the fence and rushed out to meet the weapons master's advance. The two went through a fast series of attacks and parries, with stunned Bourguignon on the defensive. Only through his years of superior training was the drow noble able to bring himself back, even against his surprising opponent. Surprising indeed, as every drow face and all the whispers confirmed.
"You brushed the fence," Bourguignon said.
The drow soldier did not disagree.
The tips of his weapons drooped as Bergignon's drooped, and he glanced over his shoulder to confirm what he and all the others knew could not be.
"You hit the fence,"
Bergignon said again, skeptically, as the drow turned back to face him.
"Across the back," he agreed.
Bergignon's swords went into their respective scabbards, and the young Béhanry stormed past his opponent to stand right before the enchanted web. His opponent and all the other dark elves followed closely, too intrigued to even think of continuing the fight. Bergignon motioned to a nearby female.
"Rest your sword against it," he bade her.
The female drew her blade and laid it across one of the thick strands. She looked to Bergignon and around to all the others, then easily lifted the blade from the fence. Another drow farther down the line dared to place his hand on the web. Those around him looked at him incredulously, thinking him dangerously daring, but he had no trouble removing himself from the metal. Panic rushed through Bergignon. The fence, it was said, had been a gift from Lolth herself in millennia past. If it was no longer functioning, it might well mean that House Béhanry had fallen out of the Spider Queen's favor. It might well mean that Lolth had dropped House Béhanry's defense to allow for a conspiracy of lower houses.
"To your posts, all of you!"
the young Béhanry shouted, and the gathered dark elves, sharing Bergignon's reasoning and his fears, did not have to be told twice. Bergignon headed for the compound's great central mound to find his mother. He crossed paths with the drow he had just been fighting, and the commoner's eyes widened in sudden fear. Normally, Bergignon, honorable only by the low standards of dark elves, would have snapped his sword out and threw the drow, ending the conflict. Caught up in the excitement of the fence's failure, the commoner was off his guard. He knew it, too, and he expected to be killed.
"To your post,"
Bergignon said to him. For if the young Béhanry's suspicions proved correct, that a conspiracy had been launched against House Béhanry and Lolth had deserted them, he would need every one of the house's 2,500 soldiers. King Brunner Battlehammer had spent the morning in the upper chapel of Mithril Hall, trying to sort out the new hierarchy of priests within the complex. His dear friend Cobble had been the reigning priest, a dwarf of powerful magic and deep wisdom. That wisdom hadn't gotten poor Cobble out of the way of a nasty drow spell, though, and the cleric had been squashed by a falling wall of iron. There were more than a dozen remaining acolytes in Mithril Hall. They formed two lines, one on each side of Brunner's audience chair. Each priest was anxious to impress his, or in the case of Stumpet Rakingclaw, her king. Brunner nodded to the dwarf at the head of the line to his left. As he did, he lifted a mug of mead, the holy water this particular priest had concocted. Brunner sipped, then drained the surprisingly refreshing mead in a single swallow as the cleric stepped forward.
"A burst of light in honor of King Brunner!"
the would-be head priest cried, and he waved his arms and began a chanting prayer to Moradin, the soul-forger, god of the dwarves.
"Clean and fresh, and just the slightest twinge of bitterness," Brunner remarked,
running a finger along the rim of the emptied mug and sucking on it that he might savor the last drop. The scribe directly behind the throne noted every word.
"A hearty bouquet, properly curling nose hairs,"
Brunner added.
"Seven."
The 11 other clerics groaned. 7 on a scale of 10 was the highest grade Brunner had given any of the 5 samples of holy water he had already taste-tested. If Jerbola, the dwarf now in a frenzy of spellcasting, could perform as well with magic, he would be difficult to beat for the coveted position.
"And the light shall be,"
Jerbola cried, the climax of his spell.
"Red!"
There came a tremendous popping noise, as if 100 dwarves had just yanked their fingers from puckered mouths, and nothing.
"Red!"
Jerbola cried in delight.
"What?"
demanded Brunner, who, like those dwarves beside him, saw nothing different about the lighting in the chapel.
"Red!"
Gerbola said again, and when he turned around, Brunner and the others understood. Gerbola's face was glowing a bright red, literally. The confused cleric was seeing the world through a rose-colored veil. Frustrated, Brunner dropped his head into his palm and groaned.
"Makes a good batch of holy water, though,"
one of the dwarves nearby remarked, to a chorus of snickers. Poor Gerbola, who thought his spell had worked brilliantly, did not understand what was so funny. Stumpet Rakingclaw leaped forward, seizing the moment. She handed her mug of holy water to Brunner and rushed out before the throne.
"I had planned something different,"
she explained quickly as Brunner sipped, then swallowed the mead. And the Dwarf King's face brightened once more as he declared this batch a 9.
"But a cleric of Moradin, of Clangadin, who knows battle best of all, must be ready to improvise."
"Do tell us, O Strumpet!"
one of the other dwarves roared, and even Brunner cracked a smile as the laughter exploded around him. Stumpet, who was used to the nickname and wore it like a badge of honor, took no offense.
"Gerbola called for red," she explained. "So red it shall be."
"It already is red,"
insisted Gerbola, who earned a slap on the head from the dwarf behind him for his foolishness. The fiery young Stumpet ruffled her short red beard and went into a series of movements so exaggerated that it seemed as if she had fallen into convulsions.
"Move it, Strumpet,"
a dwarf near the throne whispered to renewed laughter. Brunner held up the mug and tapped it with his finger.
9,
he reminded the wise cracking dwarf. Stumpet was in the clear lead. If she pulled off her spell where Gerbola had failed, she would be almost impossible to beat, which would make her the wise-cracking dwarf superior. The dwarf behind the humble jokester slapped him on the back of the head.
"Red!"
Stumpet cried with all her might. Nothing happened. A few snickers came from the line, but in truth, the gathered dwarves were more curious than amused. Stumpet was a powerful spellcaster and should have been able to throw some light, whatever color, into the room. The feeling began to wash over them all, except Gerbola, who insisted that his spell had worked perfectly, that something might be wrong. Stumpet turned back to the throne, confused and embarrassed. She started to say something, to apologize, when a tremendous explosion rocked the ground so violently that she and half the other dwarves in the room were knocked from their feet. Stumpet rolled and turned, looking back to the empty area of the chapel. A ball of blue sparks appeared from nowhere, hovered in the air, then shot straight for a very surprised Brunner. The Dwarf King ducked and thrust up his arm to block, and the mug that held Stumpet's batch of holy water shattered, sheared off at the handle. A blue storm of raging sparks burst from the impact, sending dwarves scurrying for cover. More sparking bursts ignited around the room, glowing balls zipping this way and that, thunder-like booms shaking the floor and walls.
"What in the 9 hells did ye do?"
The Dwarf King, a little curled-up ball on his great chair, screamed at poor Stumpet. The female dwarf tried to respond, tried to disclaim responsibility for this unexpected turn. But a small tube appeared in midair, generally pointed her way, and fired multicolored balls that sent Stumpet scrambling away. It went on for several long, frightening minutes, dwarves diving every which way, sparks seeming to follow them wherever they hid, burning their backsides and singeing their beards. Then it was over, as suddenly as it had begun, leaving the chapel perfectly quiet and smelling of sulfur. Gradually, Brunner straightened in his chair and tried to regain some of his lost dignity.
"What in the 9 hells did ye do?"
he demanded again, to which poor Stumpet merely shrugged. A couple of dwarves managed a slight laugh at that.
"At least it's still red,"
Gerbola remarked under his breath, but loud enough to be heard. Again he was slapped by the dwarf behind him. Brunner shook his head in disgust, then froze in place as two eyeballs appeared in the air before him, scrutinizing him ominously. Then they dropped to the floor and rolled around haphazardly, coming to rest several feet apart.
Brunner looked on in disbelief as a spectral hand came out of the air and herded the eyeballs close together and turned them so that they were both facing the dwarf king once more.
"Well, that's never happened before," said a disembodied voice.
Brunner jumped in fright, then settled and groaned yet again. He hadn't heard that voice in a long time, but never would he forget it. It explained so much about what was going on in the chapel.
"Harkle, harple,"
Brunner said, and whispers ignited all around him, for most of the other dwarves had heard Brunner's tales of Long Saddle, a town to the west of Mithril Hall, home of the legendary, eccentric wizard clan, the Harples. Brunner and his companions had passed through Long Saddle, had toured the Ivy Mansion on their way to find Mithril Hall. It was a place the dwarf, no fan of wizardly magic, would never forget and never remember fondly.
"My greetings, King Brunner,"
said the voice, emanating from the floor right below the steadied eyeballs.
"Are ye really here?"
the dwarf king asked.
"Hmm,"
groaned the floor.
"I can hear both you and those who are around me at the Fuzzy Quarterstaff,"
Harkle replied, referring to the tavern at the Ivy Mansion back in Long Saddle.
"Just a moment, if you please."
The floor hummed several more times, and the eyeballs blinked once or twice, perhaps the most curious sight Brunner had ever seen, as an eyelid appeared from nowhere, covered the ball momentarily, then disappeared once more.
"It seems that I'm in both places,"
Harkle tried to explain.
"I'm quite blind back here. Of course, my eyes are there. I wonder if I might get them back."
The spectral hand appeared again, groping for the eyeballs. It tried to grasp one of them securely, but only wound up turning the ball around on the floor.
"Whoa!"
shouted a distressed Harkle.
"So that is how a lizard sees the world. I must note it."
"Harkle!"
Brunner roared in frustration.
"Oh, yes, yes, of course,"
replied Harkle, coming to what little senses he possessed.
"Please excuse my distraction, King Brunner. This has never happened before."
"Well, it's happened now,"
Brunner said dryly.
"My eyes are there,"
Harkle said, as though trying to sort things out aloud.
"But of course, I will be there as well quite soon. Actually, I had hoped to be there now, but didn't get through. Curious indeed. I could try again, or could ask one of my brothers to try."
"No!"
Brunner bellowed, cringing at the thought that other Harple body parts might soon rain down on him.
"Of course," Harkle agreed after a moment. "Too dangerous. Too curious. Very well, then. I come in answer to your call, friend Dwarf King."
Brunner dropped his head into his palm and sighed. He had feared those very words for more than 2 10-days now. He had sent an emissary to Long Saddle for help in the potential war, only because Drizzt had insisted. To Brunner, having the Harples as allies might eliminate the need for enemies.
"A 10-day,
Harkle's disembodied voice said.
"I will arrive in a 10-day.
There came a long pause.
Could you be so kind as to keep my eyeballs safe?"
Brunner nodded to the side, and several dwarves scrambled ahead, curious and no longer afraid of the exotic items. They battled to scoop up the eyes and finally sorted them out, with 2 different dwarves each holding one, and each taking obvious pleasure in making faces at the eye. Brunner shouted for them to quit playing, even before Harkle's voice screamed in horror.
"Please!"
pleaded the somewhat absent mage.
"Only 1 dwarf to hold both eyes."
Immediately the 2 dwarves clutched their prizes more tightly.
"Give him to Stumpet!" Brunner roared. "She started this whole thing!"
Reluctantly, but not daring to go against an order from their king, the dwarves handed the eyeballs over.
"And do please keep them moist,"
Harkle requested, to which Stumpet immediately tossed one of the orbs into her mouth.
"Not like that!"
screamed the voice.
"Oh, not like that!"
"I should get them," protested Jerbola. "My spell worked!"
The dwarf behind Jerbola slapped him on the head. Brunner slumped low in his chair, shaking his head.
It was going to be a long time in putting his clerical order back together, and longer still would be the preparations for war when the Harples arrived. Across the room, Stumpet, who despite her antics was the most level-headed of dwarves, was not so light-hearted. Harkle's unexpected presence had deflected the other apparent problems, perhaps, but the weird arrival of the wizard from Longsaddle did not explain the happenings here. Stumpet, several of the other clerics, and even the scribe realized that something was very wrong. Guinevere was tired by the time she, Drizzt, and Catti Bree came to the high pass leading to Mithril Hall's eastern door. Drizzt had kept the panther on the material plane longer than usual, and though it was taxing, Guinevere was glad for the stay. With all the preparations going on in the deep tunnels below the dwarven complex, Drizzt did not get outside much, and consequently neither did Guinevere. For a long, long time, the panther figurine had been in the hands of various drow and menzo Berenzon, and thus the panther had gone centuries without seeing the out-of-doors on the material plane. Still, the out-of-doors was where Guinevere was most at home, where natural panthers lived, and where the panther's first companions on the material plane had lived. Guinevere had indeed enjoyed this romp along mountain trails with Drizzt and Catti Bree, but now was the time to go home, to rest again on the astral plane. For all their love of companionship, neither the drow nor the panther could afford that luxury now, with so great a danger looming, an impending war in which Drizzt and Guinevere would likely play a major role, fighting side by side. The panther paced around the figurine, gradually diminished and faded to an insubstantial gray mist. Gone from the material world, Guinevere entered a long, low, winding tunnel, the silvery path that would take her back to the astral plane. The panther loped easily, not eager to be gone and too tired to run full out. The journey was not so long anyway, and always uneventful. Guinevere skidded to a stop as she rounded one long bend, her ears falling flat. The tunnel ahead was ablaze. Diabolical forms, fiendish manifestations that seemed unconcerned with the approaching cat, leaped from those flames. Guinevere padded ahead a few short strides. She could feel the intense heat, could see the fiery fiends, and could hear their laughter as they continued to consume the circular tunnel's walls. A rush of air told Guinevere that the tunnel had been ruptured, somewhere in the emptiness between the planes of existence. Fiery fiends were pulled into elongated shapes, then sucked out. The remaining flames danced wildly, leaping and flickering, seeming to go out altogether, then rising together in a sudden and violent surge. The wind came strong at Guinevere's back, compelling the panther to go forward, compelling everything in the tunnel to fly out through the breach into nothingness. Guinevere knew instinctively that if she succumbed to that force, there would be no turning back, that she would become a lost thing, helpless, wandering between the planes. The panther dug in her claws and backpedaled slowly, fighting the fierce wind every inch of the way. Her black coat ruffled up, sleek fur turning the wrong way, one step back. The tunnel was smooth and hard, and there was little for panther claws to dig against. Guinevere's paws pedaled more frantically, but inevitably the cat began to slide forward toward the flames and the breach.
"What is it?"
Catti Bree asked, seeing Drizzt's confusion as he picked up the figurine. "Warm," Drizzt replied. "The figurine is warm." Catti Bree's expression likewise crinkled with confusion. She had a feeling of sheer dread then, a feeling she could not understand.
"Call Gwen back," she prompted.
Drizzt, equally fearful, was already doing exactly that. He placed the figurine on the ground and called out to the panther. Guinevere heard the call and wanted desperately to answer it, but now the cat was close to the breach. Wild flames danced high, singeing the panther's face.
The wind was stronger than ever, and there was nothing, nothing at all for Guinevere to hold on to. The panther knew fear, and the panther knew grief. Never again would she come to Drizzt's call. Never again would she hunt beside the ranger in the forests near Mithril.